The 2015 Grace Agenda Conference presents A Woman's Worth, a Lady Seminar, featuring Nancy Wilson, Becca Merkel, Rachel Jankovic, and Heather Wilson. Sponsored by Christ Church, Moscow, Idaho, copyright 2015. Enjoy the talks.
So, hello. Yes, I'm taking a day off of my teaching to come here, and it's always so much more work to leave school than to just go. So I'm sending texts like, oh, I forgot to tell the eighth graders, don't let them out the door until they've done, anyway. So I may think of something in the middle and have to quickly text my sub. So I'm supposed to speak on faithful women, and in your schedule, it's goofy. I am Becca Merkel, not Heather Wilson, and I'm speaking on faithful women. So they just switched our talk titles. So actually, when I was first given the talk title, Faithful Women, I was like, okay, yeah, I think I know where I would go with that. And then later, I saw it written down again, but slightly different. It was like, I can't remember what it was, but it was sort of like walking by faith. And I was like, wait, what? That's not what I'm talking about. And I thought, why isn't that the same thing? That's funny to say faithful women or women who walk by faith. We just think of very different things, right? And I think it's because faith is a huge word. I mean, if you've ever stopped and tried to think through what is faith, or what do we mean when we say someone has faith, or when they're faithful, we actually have very different categories. And so if I was going to get up and give a talk on being a faithful wife, it would be like, on how to not commit adultery or something. You know, like being faithful to your husband or being a faithful mom would mean something else. But if I said women of faith, that might be a bunch of like narratives of, you know, great women of the past or something. If I said walking by faith, that would be, I don't know, like maybe how to trust God through tribulation or something. If I was going to talk about being saved by faith, that would be very doctrinal and why we're not Catholic, right? So faith is just this huge word. And so when I had seen my talk as like faithful women or faithful wives, I was like, okay, I know what that is. And then when I saw it as walking by faith, I was like, whoa, that's not what I thought. But of course, that's silly. I mean, it's the same word and those things all go together, right? And I realize I think we mean two different things when we use the word as a noun or as an adjective. So if you say say it as a noun, I have a lot of faith, or she has a lot of faith, we're talking about things that we think or believe in our head. If we say she's a woman who has a lot of faith, it means she believes these things. And if we say she is an incredibly faithful woman and we use it as an adjective, we're talking about the things she does. She, you know, feeds the poor, she takes care of her kids, whatever it is. So if you use it as a noun, we're talking about things you think in your head, and when we use it as an adjective, it's like things that you're doing that are sort of visible to others. And obviously they're connected. They can't be disconnected, but they do put the emphasis on very different things. So the first is things you believe, and the second is the things that you do. Which is, you know, how like the book of Ephesians breaks down, for instance. The chapters 1 through 3 are all the things we believe, and then he gets down to brass tacks in 4 through 6 and is like, wives do this and husbands do that and children do the other thing. That's things to do. So it's things you believe first and then things that you do second, and you can't divorce them, but they are two different topics. And if you go to the Latin word for it, credenda, is things to believe, and agenda is things to be done. So that's why the magazine that started up years ago when I was a kid, Credenda Agenda, was called that. It's things we believe and then things to be done. And I think the magazine was actually broken down into like the first few pages was more doctrinal stuff and the last was more practical stuff. And I do think that that's, like I said, how the book of Ephesians treats it. It's, you know, let's talk about this, and now let's turn to the practical. But you can't just jump to the practical without that other stuff, or it's like lacking a foundation. There's no point to it. The two things are always connected. So with that in mind, the word faith being very broad, It's like, how do we define it then? What is faith? If you're going to say, what is faith? It's kind of, we use the word a lot. We kind of instinctively know what it means. But if you're going to try and really come zooming in on a definition of it, oh dear, I don't quite know. So the obvious place to look is Hebrews, right? So I thought, okay, go to Hebrews. Chapter 11, and the first verse of chapter 11, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And that's a tricky one too. I mean, if you try and like break that down, it's the substance of things that you hope for, and it's the evidence of things you don't see. That's sort of a contradiction, right? The thing that you hope for has no substance. It's just a thing you're hoping for. But faith is the substance. Like, that's something you can grasp, right? If it's a substance, it's very tangible. It's the tangible substance of something you hope for, which is very intangible. It's just that thing that you're hoping for. It's the evidence of things not seen. So evidence, again, is very right there. It's tangible. It's right in front of you. You can see it. Things not seen, by definition, you can't see it, right? Evidence is something you can see, but it's weird to have evidence of something you can't see. So there's just this interesting, I mean, that's the biblical definition. Faith is that, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So you have this tangible and intangible thing going on. And I thought, actually, that pairs with how we use the word. What we believe is kind of intangible. Things we do is very, you know, right there. You can see it. So there's always the two sides of faith and how we use the word. So again, the noun adjective thing, do you have faith or do you act faithfully, is kind of that. There's the substance, there's the intangible, there's the evidence, there's the, you know, abstract. So anyhow, that's sort of something to keep in mind, is like you can't have the one without the other, but they're not the same thing. They are very different from each other. And I think you know, we see in James, faith without works is dead. You can't just have faith without having it come out. If you just have faith privately amongst yourself and nobody else ever can see it, then that's dead faith. That's not an actual faith, right? So it's a bit like, I mean, every metaphor is going to break down, but like a seed is something that you can see, right? You can look at that seed, you know that it's there, but when you plant the acorn, you know, hoping for an oak tree, you can't see the oak tree. That's just the thing in the future. That's the intangible. You're hoping for it, but you do have something, right? There's something that you can hold on to and plant. And if you plant it and it's going into good soil and it's being watered, but it never grows, what does that tell you about the seed? It wasn't a viable seed in the first place. If you put that seed in the ground, and if it's a live seed, it's going to grow, and it's going to become something very different than what it initially looked like, right? And there will be some correspondence, you know. It's not like you put a bean in the ground and then out comes an oak tree, but, you know, there's correspondence between the two. But you have something tangible, but then there's this other thing that you're looking forward to. And so in the definition there, it's the substance of things hoped for. It is something you can grasp. It's something you can hang on to. It's not all abstract. You know, if hopefully this is making sense, but you've got two sides to it. There's always the thing you believe, and there's the thing that you do. There's the seed that you put in the ground, and if it's a live seed, it's going to turn into something else. So there's just so many interesting aspects of the word faith. And having gone to Hebrews 11, that seems like, I just thought, oh my word, this is a huge passage of the Bible about faith, which is fantastic. So we've got tangible, intangible, we've got things you believe and then things that you do. There's one other thing, though, before we just go to Hebrews 11, and that is the fact that faith is actually temporary, too. So if you go over to 1 Corinthians, so you've got Hebrews 11 is kind of the classic faith passage. If you go to 1 Corinthians 13, that's the big love passage, right? That's where we go to find out about love, and go to Hebrews to find out about faith. 1 Corinthians 13 says, for now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Okay, so right now it's, again, with this looking forward thing. Right now, it's a bit muddy, right? You might have the seed, but you can't see the tree. But you do have something. We see through a glass darkly, but then it will be face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as I also am known. And now abideth faith, hope, and charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity. That's the one that's going to stick with us. Faith and hope are going to pass away because they're not going to be necessary anymore, right? When you have the reality, you don't need hope for it anymore. When you have the thing you had faith in, you don't need the faith anymore. Faith is, by definition, it's what you have when you can't see the end. So faith is going to fall away. Hope is going to fall away, but love will endure. So that's the other thing. There's this intangibleness to it. There's the action that goes with it, but it's also temporary. It's going to eventually, faith will not be as necessary, or at least not in the form that we have it now. Because I think, again, if you look at that verse, and now abideth faith, hope, and charity, but the greatest of these is charity, because eventually we'll see face to face. Again, eventually we won't see through a glass darkly anymore. We'll have the reality. But love will continue. Love is not going to pass away, but faith and hope will drop off. So going to Hebrews then, Hebrews 11, if you have your Bible, you might as well turn to Hebrews 11, and 12 and 13, it goes on. And actually, I thought, why don't we just read Hebrews 11, 12, and 13 and call it a day, because that, I can't say it better than that. starting at the first verse, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. You could seriously sit and think about that for a very long time, but he just moves right on. For by it the elders obtained a good report. Through faith, and I think this is so interesting that this is right at the beginning, and we all know that Hebrews 11 is that great big long chapter, sort of the hall of faith, you know. The very first thing he tells us, and this is totally a side note, but I find it very interesting. Through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear, which is sort of like, first off, creation. And it's pretty much straight up saying, and not evolution, right? It was, the worlds were framed by the spoken word of God. The things we see, they weren't made out of other things that we could see. Sort of like step one, creatio ex nihilo, there you go. And then moving on. So, and then after that, it's the great heroes throughout the Old Testament. But the very first thing is like, so by faith, you know that God created the worlds and spoke them into existence, and it didn't come out of other things. And then just moving on. By faith, Abel, okay? And we know how the passage unfolds. By faith, Abel offered a sacrifice. By faith, Enoch was translated. And I also thought, oh, that's weird, too. You sort of would expect that Enoch got taken up to heaven because of his faith. That would make sense. But it says by faith. I was like, how did he do that one? I don't know. He was just translated by faith. He didn't die. He was taken to heaven because he had pleased God. And it's another one of those little verses where you're like, could you tell me more? I would really like to know what he did. Like, what was Enoch about? But he pleased God, and he had faith, and he was translated. He did not see death. And then it goes on, he pleased God. And then the author of Hebrews says, because without faith, it's impossible to please him. Okay, so we know Enoch pleased God, and he had faith. Because otherwise he couldn't have pleased God. That's how we please God. That's how. That's why he delights in us. Well, it's not, you know, we all know what comes first. But at the same time, he delights in our faith. That's how we please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is. That's just, so we've got creation. These are things that you have to believe, right? We believe that he is. You can't have faith if you don't believe that God is. You can't be, you know, an atheist and have faith in him. we have to believe that he is, and lost my place, believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So it's not just saying seek him, but you believe that he will reward that. So again, keeping in mind the sort of like things you believe and then things you do, Hebrews kind of is starting out with, this is what we believe about God. We believe that he is. We believe that he created the world. We believe that he rewards those who seek him. These are all things you affirm in your head. And then later, he'll get to the practical stuff. You know, the really like rubber meets the road moment. But right now, it's the abstract part. It's what do you believe to have faith? And then once you have done that, what does it look like? by faith, Noah, being warned of God, of things not seen as yet. And that's going to be the theme that runs throughout this whole passage on faith, is he's emphasizing these people believed when they didn't see it. They just believed it was coming, right? So it's the substance of things hoped for. It's the evidence of things not seen. So it's that looking forward part that he's going to emphasize. excuse me. So Noah was warned of God of things not seen as yet, but he believed God and he built a boat, and by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness, which is of faith. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. Again, he believed, he didn't see it. So Noah had to just start building an ark when there was absolutely no reason to build an ark. And the point is that he believed it first, but then it affected what he did, right? It would have done him no good to say, oh, I believe there's a flood coming. Yes, I do. And then not have it, you know, show up in boat building. That's kind of the point. And if he had said, yes, God, I believe you, and then he never took action, then we would be able to say, oh, you didn't actually believe God, you just said you did. So what you think is always going to come out. It is by definition connected, in the same way that the seed, when it goes in the ground, will grow. If you put it in the ground, there's nothing you can do to stop it from growing, right? If it's in the dirt and it's getting water and sun, it's going to grow and you can't make it stop. And in the same way, if you believe God, it will come out in the way that you act. And if it never does, then we can say, yeah, it wasn't a viable seed. That's not living faith, because it never grew. It never turned into anything. So noticing that Noah did what he did when he didn't yet have a reason to believe. Abraham did what he did when he didn't see anything yet. And so he was, just a guy, a pagan guy in the city of Ur. And God calls him and says, come, you know, I'm going to take you to a new land. And he went. And he didn't have any reason to do that. He didn't have any evidence in front of him. He just believed, but then he went. So if he had said, yes, I believe, and then he stayed in Ur, that we could say that wasn't really faith. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob. For he looked for a city which hath foundations. And I thought, oh man, think of that, living in a tent your whole life, waiting for a house that just stays put. Let's just have a foundation. You can feel the angst. I have a kitchen that is torn very apart at the moment. And it's like, if only I had a counter, it would be so much better. And it's like, or a dishwasher, or a ceiling that wasn't falling apart. Anyway, those things. You know, if you're living in a tent, looking forward to the time when you're going to have a city that actually stays put. And if you think about that, he never saw it. Abraham didn't get that. He didn't get to witness the city. And even when the reality happened, and his descendants inherited the, you know, land of Canaan, and they actually had cities, they didn't have to live in tents anymore. They got houses with foundations. That even wasn't the real thing. They had to look forward to something better. Because obviously this is all pointing to Christ the whole time. So Abraham, living in a tabernacle, was looking forward to just having a physical city, which was part of the promise. But that was to picture the greater promise, which he was also looking forward to. So it's just this constant looking past, looking through, looking ahead, when you don't see it yet. You just have to believe that it's coming. So Abraham, looking forward, Sarah received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child because she judged him faithful who had promised. And so again, she's 100 years old. Like, that's not happening. But she believed, even though she couldn't see it yet. And then it obviously was brought to fruition. And then it goes on in verse 13. And I think this is really crucial to see. They all died in faith, not having received the promises. So these were all great people of faith, and they died before they saw it. So it wasn't like, oh, just hang on for a few years, and then, you know, eventually you'll see the promise, and that'll be good. They had to walk in faith. They had to leave their country. They had to move away. They had to build an ark. They had to do all these things. And then they actually died before they saw what they were waiting for. And And so I think that that is the essence of faith. That's the thing the author keeps pointing out. They died. They didn't actually see it, but they had faith. So they hadn't received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. So even though Abraham was looking forward to the land of Canaan, that was a picture of, you know, the new heavens and the new earth. We're just strangers and pilgrims here. All of them were looking forward to something better, and so they couldn't see it. By definition, they're going to die before they see that. Verse 14, for they say such things, declare plainly that they seek a country. So in the same way that Abraham was seeking a country, all of us are seeking a country that we have to die before we're going to see it. But the essence of faith is believing that that's coming. And I know this is a women's conference, but this part looks exactly the same for both men and for women. When you get into the practical side, what does faithfulness look like? It's going to look different on women than it does on men. It's going to look different on moms than it does on daughters. It's going to look different on everybody, whatever station in life that you have. Faithfulness will look different, but faith looks exactly the same. So we have the same faith that Abraham had, and he was, you know, from Ur. And I think we have very little in common with Abraham aside from the faith. We'd probably be appalled, actually, if we met Abraham in real life. Be like, what? He's not going to heaven, surely. Oh, my word. You learn much about these ancient civilizations, and it's a little scary. So anyway, you know, we don't have a lot in common with him, except that faith, looking forward to something better. And truly, it says in verse 15, truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had the opportunity to have returned. So the thing is, you're not supposed to be looking. You're looking at something that's far off, something you can't see yet. If you go back to the 1 Corinthians passage, we see through a glass darkly. You know, we don't quite know, but we still are supposed to have our eyes on that. And it's murky, like we're seeing through a glass darkly. We don't know what it is, but neither did Abraham, neither did Noah, neither did Enoch. All of them were looking forward to something else. And eventually we'll have the real thing. And if we stop looking there and we start looking at the tangible things around us that we can see, the things that feel more real to us, the things that are much more solid, then we could get distracted and turn back, right? You have to remember that you're seeking another country. Because if you start being too mindful of this one, from whence they came out, they might have had the opportunity to return. Like the Israelites in the desert when they started feeling like, this isn't fun. Let's go back to Egypt. It was great there. You know, and it, of course it wasn't great there, but distance kind of washes away some of those details, and they wanted to go back. And it's like, well, at least we had food, and we hate manna, and life is horrible. And that's what we can do, is get easily distracted. If we take our eyes off of what we're supposed to be pointed towards, then we can end up veering off. And then, of course, we get to, by faith, Abraham, who's sort of the archetypical example of faith. Abraham offered up Isaac. And that's tricky, because first he had to have faith that he's going to have a son. And he does that. And then he gets a son. And then God says, yeah, you're going to need to kill him now. And it's like, what? You know, I just went through this whole thing and had the faith and finally got the son. Now I finally see it. And now you're going to have to kill him. But he did. He laid him on the altar. It was still looking forward and not getting distracted by the things around us that we can see. And then he believed that God could raise him up, even from the dead, which is how we know that, you know, when Abraham went up that mountain, he said, we will come back to you. He believed that he was going to have to kill him, but he also believed God was going to give him back because he believed the promise that through Isaac, your seed will be reckoned. So he's like, I believe God's promises. I don't know why he's asking me to kill my son right now, because that would seem to contradict the promise. So he chose to believe God and say he's going to raise him from the dead. And so that's why it was an act of faith. He still believed God's promise, even when it looked like God was changing his mind. And he said, we will come back off of this mountain. And then, of course, we know God had another plot twist there, and he didn't have to raise him from the dead. But then we get, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob blessed the sons of Joseph. By faith, Joseph planned for his bones And I think that's just such an interesting one to pick out of all the things you could pick from Joseph's life, because he's looking forward to the country, right? He's looking forward to the promise. He says, take my bones with you when you go. Don't leave them here in Egypt. So that's his act of faith, because he's looking past. He's looking to the thing he's not going to see because he's going to be dead, but he's still looking at it. By faith, Moses was hid 3 months. So his parents showed faith by hiding him. And then by faith, Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And then verse 25, I think, is so interesting, because he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. I think some translations say fleeting pleasures, which is so good. It's like he chose to suffer affliction rather than go for the fleeting pleasures of sin. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. And it's so interesting to think of Moses choosing Christ. It's like he actually picked Christ over Egypt. And you're thinking, but he's Old Testament. He didn't know about that yet. But he picked Christ rather than the treasures of Egypt. And he didn't choose the passing pleasures of sin. By faith, he forsook Egypt. Like, he had nothing to go on, right? He had to just wander off into the desert with a bunch of obstinate, recalcitrant people who were very difficult. And there we go. Off he went into the desert with them. I mean, if you've ever tried to, you know, like, herd a little kindergarten class across the street or something, you know how hair-raising that is. And then think of Moses with millions of them in the desert. It's like, oh, it's the worst. By faith, he kept the Passover. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. By faith, Rahab didn't die. She was saved by the people. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets. Like, we could go on and on, right? But all of these people were acting with faith. And the thing that's noticeable up to this point is these are all people who were vindicated. Like, Rahab showed faith and then she was saved, right? And Moses showed faith and then the people got out and the Egyptians drowned. And Abraham showed faith and he was given a son when he was old. And then he showed faith and he wasn't killed. And it was all like, hooray, 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 happy endings. But then he changes, lest we think that that's the only way the story of faith goes. And he says, but time would fail me. And then he doesn't get specific with names, but he says, some subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. There were those who had great victories, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, but others were tortured. Right? So you have this great list of victories. All these people showed faith and hooray, it worked out for them. And they got the happy ending. But we're even told, even through those, that that's not what it was really about. They were given the happy ending here, but they were still looking forward to something else. And then we get to the ones who were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection, which tells us they're looking to that. They're looking to the resurrection. They don't want the deliverance right this minute because they have their eye on something that's further away, something that they can't see yet. Others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds, imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder. They were tempted, slain with the sword, wandered about in sheepskins, goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy, which is such a great line. They wandered in deserts, in mountains, in dens, in caves of the earth. And these, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. So the people who had the happy ending, they died without receiving the promise, even though it was a happy ending. But they still died without the promise, and these people died without receiving the promise. So everyone dies without seeing the promise. That's sort of built in, except for Enoch. And he was translated without seeing the promise. And God, having provided some better things for us, that they without us should not be made perfect, they're waiting for us, right? So they had to die without receiving the promise, and they're still waiting for us, so we can all receive it together. And so this part is where he's just describing sort of like, it's their actions, but it's more what they believed. It was they were looking for something far away, something they couldn't see yet. And some of them had great victories, and some had their dead raised, and some, you know, had cities fall down, and some of them received vineyards they didn't plant, and orchards they didn't plant, and houses they didn't build, and others were tortured to death. But all of them were looking to something past that. And so then it goes to the chapter 12, which was much more, starts to get into the kind of practical side. So you've got the faith, the things that they believed, the things they were looking at. But then chapter 12 is going to sort of change a little bit, and it's going to go more into the sort of, as an adjective, faith as an adjective. What does it look like when you walk by faith? When you believe that first, what does it look like? And you can't produce the fruit of it if you don't have the seed of it. And you can't have the seed without it actually producing fruit. The two are tied together. So again, faith without works is dead. You can't just sit quietly in your bedroom your whole life and have that be faith. So some of these heroes, before we turn to the other side, some of them overcame, some were overcome, but one thing that was very noticeable is none of them had it easy. Even the ones who had the happy ending, it's not like the story of they had tons of money and great clothes and soft pillows and good complexions until they died, or were translated like Enoch. That's not the story. Even the ones that had the happy ending, the whole point is they had trials, they had afflictions, they had to wait till they were 100 before they had a baby, and then they were told to kill him. Or, you know, it wouldn't have been fun to be Noah. Even though it's good to not drown in the worldwide flood, that's still not fun. I mean, think of being the only ones left on the planet and wandering out, just the 8 of us and some animals. You know, all of them had hard times, even when they were saved, even when it was in the here and now, it was the happy ending. All of them had trials. Moses had huge triumphs, but huge afflictions. And so the thing that's important to see is that every faithful person, whether you're tortured to death or whether you are the hero of the story that conquers, all of them go through adversity. All of them go through trials. That's the whole point. So the thing that distinguishes them is that they kept their eye on the ball the whole time. Like, they were always looking out there, no matter what was going on right here. So they kept their eyes out. And so I think Ben and I went like a year or two ago down to Walla Walla, there's some wineries and vineyards a few hours away. And there was a funny vineyard that we kept hearing about, and this wine that was this elusive wine, and I don't know if it's good because nobody ever tastes it. So it's so limited and so exclusive that no one can have any. So they... And it's funny, we heard about this everywhere we went. They're like, well, have you tried Cayuse? Like, no, we haven't. And they have a little storefront on downtown with their winery that's always closed. And they open it maybe one day a year. And if you want to get on their wine club list, you can't. So anyway, it's this mythical wine. And the thing that's supposed to be so good about it is that these vineyards are grown down in this ridiculous rocky patch where you're not supposed to plant grapes. And the story, and like I said, it could be just all entirely an urban legend and there isn't a vineyard there. But this French guy, winemaker, came to Walla Walla and he was looking for a spot and he picked this like gungy, bad, rocky section to put his vineyards in. And everybody thought he was nuts because they were putting him in all the beautiful, you know, well-lit places or something. And he put it in the rocky soil. He planted his vineyards in this really rocky. We went down and looked at it, and they're huge, like big stones. It's just like giant pea gravel. And he put his vineyards down there. And his reasoning was it's the bad soil forces the roots to go down very deep, and it produces the best grapes, which produces the best wine. And I thought, whether or not there's any wine down there, that's a great image, right? It's the rocky soil that produces the sweetest fruit. If they grow, if they flourish, if they actually send their roots down and they don't just keel over and die. So when God gives us afflictions and trials, it's meant to make us sweeter, right? And if we keep our eyes on what we're supposed to keep our eyes on, it will have that effect. I think, is it Watson, one of those Puritans who said, is it Watson, when I'm in the cellar of affliction, Rutherford, sorry. When I'm in the cellar of affliction, I look for God's choicest wines. And it's not just that. He's making you into his choicest wines when you're in affliction. Because that's what those things are there for, is to teach us to look past them, look beyond them, and keep your eye on what's coming next. So even, I think we do this instinctively, you just in life, on a small scale, when you're walking around. Because if you're trying to walk across the room, where do you put your eyes? You hopefully aren't looking straight down at the 6 inches right in front of your feet, because that may seem like safety first, but you will bump into things and fall over, right? If you're only looking right here, that's why they don't want you to text and drive at the same time, right? You're supposed to be looking out there, and then of course you glance down to make sure you're not about to trip in the sidewalk crack or something. You know, you have to look down, but you're keeping your eyes out there. And I think that's what we're supposed to be doing through life, is of course we can't pretend that the world's not here and the afflictions aren't here and my life isn't here. I'm just going to think about heaven. Somebody else witty said, someone is so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good, which is not what you want to be either. You have to look down. God puts these things in our lives, the blessings and the afflictions, because it is through them that we will be sanctified, made sweeter. So we have to interact with them and deal with them, but you still have to keep your eyes focused on where you're going. If you just get caught up in this, then you'll, trip and fall down and want to go back to Egypt. So how do you tell then, if that's what you're doing? Which is difficult, because sometimes you feel like if it was just really cut and dry, if God appeared to me and said, pack up your house and move to Canaan, you could say, all right, there you go, that's straightforward. But how do you tell if you're looking in faith? How do you tell, maybe you're surrounded by trials, maybe you're surrounded by blessings. How do you tell if you're looking past them or looking through them or, in the right way? Especially, I think, if we're surrounded by blessings. Because we all know that we're driven to prayer much more when we're sick, right? When something's hard, when you have a big financial crisis, when you're feeling sick, when your kids are sick, when something's bad, that's when you're driven to prayer quite a bit more. When everything's going gloriously along, you kind of forget a lot of the time. And so it's, I think, much easier to keep focused when we do have trials. When we have everything going our way is when it's really easy to doze off and not pay attention. So if you're in a spot where you are surrounded by trials, then look through them, look past them. Look to the thing that Abraham and Moses and Enoch and all the old heroes had to look for, which is something they were never going to see. So it might not get resolved on this side, of the resurrection. If you have cancer, that might not go away. But the thing is, all of us are going to die at some point, right? It's not going to work out all the way through. At some point, we're all going to die. And so whether we end on a happy note or a sad note is kind of irrelevant. All of us are going to have to die, and we're looking past that to something else. So how do you tell? And I think the question is, are you using your stuff, your blessings, your house, your cars, your clothes, all of those fun things that it's so easy to get distracted by, are you using them to serve God, or do they distract you from God? And I think that's the key. And, you just have to look at it honestly and say, are these a distraction for me, or am I using them to help me turn towards God, to sacrifice for him, or am I distracted by it? And so it's not about whether the circumstances should be changed. If God's heaped blessings on you, awesome, but you have to keep your eyes up there and not down here, or you'll get distracted, like I said. So then going on to chapter 12, this is where he kind of turns from that list of, this is what they're doing. They're looking forward to something that they're never going to see. They never got the promise. They had their eyes up there. Some of them had great victories. Some were defeated, but all of them had faith. Now, and then he turns to the beginning of chapter 12, therefore, seeing we are compassed with so great a cloud of witnesses, and then he moves on. So there's the therefore is important. You can't just focus on the like, okay, what am I going to do? Here's what I need to do. You have to remember that whole first part. The therefore is important. He's not changed the subject. He's just gone to the next sort of, you know, premise one, premise two. They go together. So we're surrounded by faithful witnesses, and honestly, that list of heroes weren't really. Abraham wasn't surrounded by a huge cloud of witnesses. He was just on his own, right? He had to just wander out of Ur with this God that he'd never heard of, turn away from the idols that he kind of knew and the idols of his father's house, and wander away, right? He didn't have a great cloud of witnesses, but we actually do. And so to whom much is given, much is required. We have this huge host of people who have gone before us, and Abraham did not. And the first thing he says to do is lay aside the sin, which so easily ensnares us, which is so true. It's like, okay, you're surrounded by this cloud of witnesses. You believe all this stuff. Step one, lay aside the sin, because that's going to be the first thing that's going to get you bogged down and get you distracted and mess you up. So lay aside the sin. And I think the one thing he's emphasizing over and over through this is the sin is so fleeting. It's just so fleeting. So like Moses chose Christ, he chose affliction with the people of Israel rather than the fleeting pleasures of sin. And in the moment, that's a hard choice, because even if the pleasure is fleeting, at least it's pleasure, right, as opposed to affliction. But he chose that because he could see which one was long-term and which one was fleeting. And I think he emphasizes that all the way through here, is like, it's such a fleeting pleasure and it's so not worth it. So Esau, you know, because he was hungry and he really wanted the stew and it smelled really good. So he sold his whole birthright for it. And we're told that he regretted it a lot later and he couldn't get it back, right? So the thing is, it's so not worth it when you weigh it in the balance. And so what he's saying is, okay, look, guys, if your eyes are up there, lay aside the sin that so easily ensnares us, and which is so fleeting and so stupid. And then the second thing, so first lay aside that sin. And of course, we all have our own different sins that we're supposed to lay aside. Lay aside the sin which so easily ensnares us. And then run with patience. So keep going. Don't get sick of it and tired, and don't quit. Just keep going. Run with patience. Look to Jesus. And this I thought was interesting. Look to Jesus. So in terms of like, what do you keep your eyes on? Keep your eyes on Jesus. But then it says, because he had to look past. He had to look past the suffering to the joy that was set before him. So it's like, as we're trying to look past and look through whatever the trials are or whatever the blessings are, look to Jesus. He also had to look past. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. So look to Jesus as the ultimate example, and consider him lest ye be wearied, which I like. It's like, run with patience, look at him when you get tired. And especially when you find yourself saying things like, I'm just so tired and having babies is so hard and haven't had too much sleep and also, you know, I have allergies. It's like when we're tempted to get tired out and feel sorry for ourselves, look to Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. I'm sure you can cope with, you know, colicky baby, right? And that's what you're supposed to do, is look to Jesus when you get tired, because he endured the cross. And that's what you're supposed to keep your eyes on. And then I love the verse that is like, because let's be honest, you haven't resisted the point of blood in your fight against sin, which is just so good, because it's like, yeah, I didn't do that yet. I haven't resisted to the point of blood. I like the story Mom tells about when she was having a hard day with the laundry and us kids being fiends or something, and she called my grandmother for a little word of encouragement, and my grandma was like, well, let me tell you about this missionary who was hung by his feet for 6 months, and his wife had to come feed him with a spoon or a straw or something. Anyway, it was not like the little bit of encouragement that she was looking for. But that's kind of what's happening in Hebrews. It's like, because let's be real, you haven't resisted the point of blood. Lots of these other people, they were torn asunder. They were sawed in two. They lost everything. You haven't done that. So look to Jesus when you're tempted to be tired and sick of it. So then we go to the next thing he tells us, despise not the chastening of the Lord. So trials and afflictions are the love of God for us. So like those rocks in the vineyard, those are God's love. He chastens those whom he loves. He chastens his sons. And there's quite a long, lengthy passage here. So when he's telling us, like, this is what faith looks like. Here's what faith believes. Then here's what faith looks like. The first, you know, big one is don't be surly and hard for people to chasten you or for God to chasten you, right? Be soft, be tender, be easily entreated, be quick to repent. And it's just the sign of God's love for us that he chastens us. And it's never pleasant at the time, but it's for our own good. So if he's pruning you, right, if God is pruning you, he has his eye on something in the future. He's looking forward too. And we're supposed to be looking forward to that, even though we don't see it. And we're looking through a glass darkly. And when God's pruning us, it's not pleasant. And it's like, well, when I would try and purge the toys when my kids were little, I could not do it with them in the house because you know how it is. Like, every single one is their very favorite. And, like, that is the favorite one. And it's an old, broken Happy Meal toy, but it's the best. You can't throw it away. And that's kind of how we are with our little pet things. It's like, you can't take that, God. That's my best branch. And he cuts it off, right? Because he has his eye on something better. He has his eye on something in the future. And I don't remember if I was supposed to end now or in 15 minutes. Yeah, okay, all right. So, anyways, the point is that we have to, I'm just going to go through lunch. That's the problem. Just read chapters 11, 12, and 13. It sums it up. But basically, there's the two parts that they can never be disconnected, right? The things that you believe, and it's if your eyes are on what they're supposed to be on, the rest of it comes easily, and it will come, right? If your eyes are where they're supposed to be, you will move in that direction, and God will bring you along. But don't despise the chastening of the Lord. So be easily entreated. Lay aside the sins, because they're never fun. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, they are not fun. But sometimes we get this exquisite pleasure out of feeling sorry for ourselves, or about having a hard time, or about being a victim, or about whatever it is. We love it. We cherish it, even though the whole fun of it is sitting there thinking of what a sad time we're having. Right? It's not actually fun, but it's such a fleeting, ridiculous pleasure when you're supposed to have your eye up there. So basically, when you're surrounded by blessings, look through them, and when you're surrounded by trials, look past them, and remember what you're supposed to have your eye on, which is Christ. All right? Thank you.